we are continuing talking about working our way through the Bible together, taking these 10 months of the school year and working our way from Genesis through Revelation. And so just to remind you of where we've been, it has always been God's intention for the people of Israel to be a set-apart people, a holy people. God called Abraham from among all the people of the world and made a covenant with Abraham and Sarah that their descendants would be God's chosen people, and that they would be given a land that was promised to them that they would have for all the generations to come. And even when the people were unfaithful and when they were enslaved in Egypt, God was faithful to them. God heard their cries and sent to them Moses to deliver them. And so they were delivered out of Egypt, and eventually they came back to this land that had been promised to them. And they were given the land once again. They conquered it, although not all the way. But it was always God's intent for the people not to have a king or a queen, but instead for God to be their sovereign, to be their ruler. To look to God and not to another human being, to lead them, to guide them, to be their example, to show them how to live, to give them their commandments, to bring justice to the land and to the people. And so we heard about the stories of the judges, in which they weren't kings or queens, they just were people who were brought forward at certain points in time to lead the people. But the people always, after the judge left, they went astray. They were unfaithful once again. And their story, of course, is our story as well. And so the people of Israel, they got fed up with this kind of cycle that they were in, and they were looking at the people of the other lands and said, we want to be like them. We have all these other ways that we're set apart. There's certain food that we don't eat. There's certain clothing that we don't wear. There's certain practices that we don't do. But in this way, we want to be like the nations of the world. We want a king to rule over us. And so God eventually relents and says, okay, if you want a king, I will give you a king. I think it's a bad idea, but it's what you want, and so I will give that to you. And so Saul is anointed the first king over Israel. Last week, we learned about King David, the greatest king in the history of Israel, a king who united all the 12 tribes together, who set Jerusalem as the capital, who moved the Ark of the Covenant there, a king who conquered many nations and many other people, a king who brought prosperity to the people of Israel. He's described as a man after God's own heart. And yet last week we learned that his heart wasn't always after God. It was after other things as well. David, when he passes away, there is some struggle for who would be the king after him, but his son Solomon takes the throne. And as Solomon ascends to the throne, God comes to Solomon in a dream and says, I will grant you one wish. It's almost like a genie in a bottle, right? I will give you one wish. Whatever you wish for, I will give you this thing because you are the king. And Solomon could have wished for wealth. He could have wished for great power. He could have wished for hundreds of women to marry. He ended up getting all those things. But what he wished for was wisdom. Wisdom. Oh, that those in power in our world today would wish for wisdom. God was pleased with this wish that Solomon asked for, and so God granted him this wish, and Solomon was known for his great wisdom. Perhaps the most famous story of Solomon is around wisdom. There were these two women, each who had newborn babies, and they lived in the same household, and one of the babies died, one of the baby boys. And so there is this dispute among the women of who this baby that is still living belongs to. One says it's hers, the other says it's hers, and so they come to the king to decide this dispute. And they say, this baby, it's mine, no, it's mine, and there's this argument before Solomon, and Solomon says, stop. We will divide the child in half. We'll cut him right in half so that each of you can have half the child, because there's no way to tell whose child this is. And one of the mothers seems content with this. It seems fair to her, but the other protests. She says, no, of course not. I don't want this child to be killed. The other woman can have him. And so Solomon knows that the second woman is the true mother of this child, for the mother would not want any harm to be done to her son. Solomon's wisdom in action. Solomon is known as the writer of the Proverbs, all these words of wisdom in the Bible. And there were people who came from all over the world to hear of his great wisdom and his knowledge of animals and plants and all kinds of things. There's this whole big section in the book devoted to the Queen of Sheba coming and being delighted and amazed at Solomon's wisdom. The other thing that Solomon is probably most well known for is building the temple in Jerusalem. David had wanted to build the temple as a place for God to dwell, for God's people to come and to worship, but David had been involved in so much warfare, he had so much blood on his hands that God said, no, it's not for you to build, but your son. Your son can build this temple. And so Solomon did, and it was a beautiful and magnificent and splendid thing, filled with all kinds of gold and artifacts and beautiful pieces of art and all kinds of things. Wood that was shipped in from across the world, all this effort put into making this temple beautiful and glorious for the glory of God. And so that's when we think of Solomon, we typically think of those two things, his great wisdom and the temple that he built. But Solomon, like David, his heart wandered. As our scripture passage said, Solomon had these many wives from all sorts of different nations, which made a lot of sense in those days. It would make peace to those nations by marrying some of the princesses from there. But especially towards his old age, Solomon began to have his heart taken away from God and to the gods of these other places. So he started to worship these other gods. He built temples and other things to worship and made sacrifices and all this kind of stuff. And so because of his unfaithfulness, because of the unfaithfulness of all of Israel, the kingdom would be divided. That's the proclamation that we hear at the end of this story. And so in the end, after Solomon dies, there is a struggle for the throne. And the kingdom gets divided north and south. In the north, a man by the name of Jeroboam takes the throne. His father was one of Solomon's best servants, and he just feels entitled and wants to do things better than Solomon was doing, and so he decides to take the throne. But Rehoboam is Solomon's son, and he takes the throne in the south. So this kingdom is divided for the rest of its existence. Israel in the north, two tribes, remain in the southern kingdom. Its capital remains in Jerusalem, and so it becomes the capital, the center of that kingdom. That's the place where they go and worship. The northern kingdom's capital moves around a few places, and its worship is in a few places. But as you can see in this map, Samaria eventually becomes kind of the main place for the northern kingdom. And things exist like this for many generations. There are all these lists of kings of the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom. But eventually in the year 722 BC, the Assyrian army is the great superpower in the world at that time, and they are kind of to the north of Israel, and they are conquering all these different countries, and they come and they conquer the northern kingdom, but they make peace with the southern kingdom. And so Israel, the northern kingdom, is wiped out. They are no more. The people are dispersed across the world, and other people come in and move in, and we kind of trace this back to Jesus' day and the resentment between the Jews and the Samaritans, right? This is Samaria, the northern kingdom. Things exist like that for a while, but then in the year 587, a new global superpower has come forward, and it's the Babylonian Empire, which is to the north and to the east. East is your direction that way. And so they, again, do what superpowers do. They're trying to conquer as much land and as much people as they can, and they come and they sack Jerusalem. They tear down the walls, they destroy the buildings in the city, they destroy even the magnificent temple that Solomon had built. And they are devastated, the people of Judah. All their leaders are sent into exile into Babylon, and other people come and live in the cities and all this. And that's where we'll pick up next week with the story of Esther. It's set during that time period. But for about 400 years, Israel, Judah in particular, was its own nation, independent, ruled by David and his lineage. And so we have this list of kings, all these kings in the north and in the south, and most of them are unremarkable, I would say. Most of us probably can't name all those kings. Most of us, you know, we would mention a name and wouldn't have any kind of recognition. Most of them are described as pretty terrible, as leading the people away from God rather than toward God. Perhaps the biggest example of this is Ahab and his wife Jezebel. Do you know that Jezebel was a Bible character? Yeah, she super unfaithful to God, right? So we have that. There were a few kings, though, who tried to be faithful and who tried to call the people back to faithfulness to God. Josiah and Hezekiah, in particular, are two kings that institute all these reforms and try to bring worship back to God and back to the temple and to tell people not to worship these other gods anymore, but to worship the one true God. But most of the time, that voice is not coming from the kings. The kings are interested in their own power, their own self-preservation, not so much in the goodness of the people, but the prophets. The prophets are the ones who speak for God and who call the people back to faithfulness. And faithfulness looks like two different things. There's faithfulness in our worship to God and our devotion to God, and so turning away from false idols and those things and worshiping God and making the sacrifices that God had prescribed. But the other part of faithfulness is loving one another. As Jesus said, the summary of the law is to love God and to love our neighbor as ourself. And those two go hand in hand. And so the prophets were calling people to faithfulness to God, but faithfulness to one another and what it means to love as well. To seek justice in the land and to care for those who are oppressed and who don't have enough. And there is this constant tension throughout the history of Israel between the kings and the prophets. Here pictured are Elijah and Elisha, but there's Isaiah and Jeremiah and Ezekiel and all the others that are named in the Bible are pretty much all during this same time period, several hundred years. And there's always this tension between the kings and the prophets. Because the kings want to go one direction and the prophets are calling them back to faithfulness to God and to the people. And the prophets over and over again warn that unless we become more faithful, bad things will begin to happen. And that's exactly what does happen. The northern kingdom is conquered. The southern kingdom is conquered. The temple is destroyed. People are lost and exiled. So I begin to wonder what that looks like today. As Emily talked about, we don't have kings today in our nation, but we certainly have leaders. And I'm not trying to talk politics here, but I think pretty much every leader that we've ever had has a heart who, at one point, is for the people and looking for good, but at other points, looks for their own power and their own interest. And so who are the people today who act like the prophets of old? Who are the people today who call us as a nation, as a people, as a church, as a community to faithfulness? Faithfulness to God and faithfulness to one another. For again, those go hand in hand. And I wonder how we might step into the role of the prophet. How we as the people of God might speak the voice of God into our world today. And call our church, call our community, call our state, call our nation, call our families faithful to God's people for thousands of years. And faithfulness to one another. To love our neighbor as ourselves. To care for those who are oppressed and marginalized here in Nashville and around the world, to provide a home for orphans in Africa, to provide a place to sleep for those who are experiencing homelessness here in Nashville. How will we be the prophets of today? We can do that by writing letters. We can do that by voting. We can do that by all kinds of other things. But I fear that we are headed towards a tipping point. I don't want to sound too prophetic, but the prophets kept saying, if we keep going down this path, bad things are going to happen. And I wonder if we're in a similar place in our world today. I saw the movie Joker yesterday. Some of you may have seen it. You may have heard about the controversy around it. But part of what it depicts is a world in which people are divided so much that it brings about violence and that change must happen. And I wonder if we're close to that point in our world today. If people are so divided over so many different things that change must happen. I don't know about you, but I don't want the kind of change that came with empires coming in and wiping out entire groups of people. I want the kind of change that's brought about by love, by faithfulness to God, and by faithfulness to one another. And so may we live into that, and may we call one another, even those who are in power, into greater faithfulness. May we love God, and may we love our neighbor. Amen.